here on WGTDHD and Wisconsin Public Radio on Friday, this coming Friday at 7 p.m. It will also air on C-SPAN and Wisconsin I. Kenosha County Executive Samantha Kirkman will hold her next Saturdays in the Park with Sam event this coming Saturday, October 15th, at Bristol Woods Park. The event will be held from 10 to 11 a.m. at the pavilion located alongside the road that leads into the park. The park is located at 9800 160th Avenue. That's Highway MB in Bristol. In sports, the Lady Falcons from Westosha Central High School are back on top as the state girls golf champions. For the second consecutive year, they won the WIAA Division I State Championship yesterday. In second place was Middleton, and third place, Union Grove. Taking a look at our weather, we can expect thunderstorms before 3 p.m. Highs will be in the mid-60s, and for tonight, a 30% chance of showers, mainly before 11 p.m. You're listening to WGTD, where we have news in the morning four times an hour.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today's morning show interview is from the morning show archives, again on the topic of Alzheimer's. I am truly honored to be speaking today on the morning show with a former governor of the state of Wisconsin and a highly regarded public servant by the name of Martin J. Schreiber. But the reason we are talking with Martin J. Schreiber today has nothing to do with his life in politics or any of the other success that he has enjoyed. Rather, we are talking about an intensely personal story unique to Mr. Schreiber in some respects, and yet a story with which so many people can relate. Martin J. Schreiber has a beautiful wife named Elaine, but Elaine is succumbing slowly but surely to Alzheimer's disease. And Martin Schreiber has written a breathtakingly beautiful and moving book about the experience of trying to weather this trial in this memoir called My Two Elaines, Learning, Coping, and Surviving as an Alzheimer's Caregiver. In this book, he describes the life that they enjoyed together for so many decades, and then the emergence of Alzheimer's in his wife, and the way in which he has valiantly tried and once in a while failed to deal with this challenge in the healthiest way. And he's learned some lessons, many of them painful lessons along the way. And with disarming honesty, he has shared about all of that in this book, which includes all kinds of very tangible suggestions, particularly a number of suggestions or thoughts in terms of things he wishes he himself had done differently. And he hopes that others can benefit from his lessons, his occasional missteps. But mostly this is an uplifting story about how love has survived. Once again, this book is My Two Elaines, Learning, Coping, and Surviving as an Alzheimer's Caregiver. And Martin J. Schreiber, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, my goodness, after that kind of introduction, I want you to know I am truly pleased and honored to be with you. And I tell you, with that kind of introduction, my talk better be good, I'll tell you that, when I talk with the people over there. But I thank you for that so very, very much. And again, I'm pleased and honored to be with you.
Well, I really found your book so very, very touching. And I heard you interviewed, actually, over Wisconsin Public Radio. I don't remember the host on the Ideas Network, but it was a very powerful, poignant conversation. So that makes me all the more excited and grateful for this opportunity. Ahead of us talking about the whole business of Alzheimer's, I want you to take a minute or two to describe the beautiful life that you and your wife Elaine enjoyed together before Alzheimer's came on the scene. Say a word, perhaps, about the circumstances under which you met, and the very, very happy marriage which you enjoyed for so many years.
Well, thank you. Elaine and I met when we were freshmen in high school in Latin class. And when I saw her, I just knew at the age of 14, I just knew that she was the person, the woman, the girl that I wanted to marry and spend the rest of my life with. And at a very early age, I wanted to serve in public life. And as we grew to know each other more and she began to adjust to that kind of thinking and began to get used to, you know, knowing what I wanted to do, she became ever more supportive. And so from the very beginning, I had a friend, a dear friend who was supportive, who was understanding, who I could talk with, who I could share things with and have some guidance from. And of course, with that first meeting, the engagement, the marriage, four children, 13 grandchildren, five great-grandchildren. And I, of course, ran for elected office, and I won some, and I lost some. And when I lost, she never let me feel defeated and always helping me understand the bright side, wishes of the voter and so forth. And so just a true companion, a true friend, and someone I could talk to. And it is a great life. And I say is because even though the first Elaine is no longer there, even though there is this new person who is someone I can no longer really visit with and talk to or receive guidance from or share thoughts and ideas with because her mind simply isn't there. But we still have these moments of joy that allows us to laugh together and to just sort of share her small world with the kind of affection. The other day, for example, she many times asked me if I love her, and I said, yes, I love you. I said, not only that, but I said, I want to marry you. Oh, she said, really? That would make me so happy. And so I don't know how many men have ever had a chance to have their loved one tell them the second, third, fourth, and fifth time that they're so happy that they want to get married. And one thing also that this new Elaine is a very loving, caring person. And the other day she asked me, she started to cry, and I said, well, why are you crying? And she looked at me, we were at lunch, and she said, well, she said, I'm beginning to love you more than I love my husband. Well, I didn't ask her what's wrong with your turkey husband, but the point of the matter is that our hearts were touching, and she didn't have to know who I was. She didn't have to know that we were married and had four children. All we had to know with one another that we were together.
Right.
And then also we had a conversation, and she says, how long will you love me? And I wanted to assure her, so I said, Elaine, I will love you forever and ever and a billion years. Well, then she looked so sad. I said, why are you sad? She said, I don't think I could take you for that long of a period of time. And so we sort of have these moments of joy. And what I would want to share with everyone is that if Alzheimer's is bad, which it is, the one thing worse than Alzheimer's is ignorance of the disease. And because one is ignorant of the disease, you don't know how to handle it well, and you bring on yourself and on your loved ones so much additional frustration and despair and anxiety that, well, there's a saying, rather than worrying about the storm to pass, to learn how to dance in the rain. And there is no caregiver that is ever going to dance, but there are caregivers who, if we learn more about the disease, we can at least have a better chance of dealing with this as as there is rain, as there's this bad weather. And I feel so, there are things, as you pointed out, that I learned too late. There were things that I didn't learn soon enough. And the medical profession is not really as aware of this disease and the impact on caregivers as they could or should. Employers are not as aware. The banking industry, financial advisors, anyone who has contact with the ever-growing number of people that are affected and afflicted by this disease. And so the goal is to help caregivers cope, learn, and survive, but the goal is to help also other people become more aware of this disease so that they in turn can take away some of the stigma of it, but also to, so to speak, learn how to dance in the rain and to, even though there is this sadness and there's this lack of hope, there are still these moments of joy that you can snatch that turn the saddest of diseases into some happy moments together. And for those moments, I rejoice. For those moments, I give thanks and appreciate the new Elaine even that much more.
We're speaking with Martin J. Schreiber about his book, My Two Elaines, Learning, Coping, and Surviving as an Alzheimer's Caregiver. Martin Schreiber has been with his wife, Elaine, for more than 60 years, but in a sense, as the title suggests, he feels in a sense as though he has lost the first Elaine, the woman that he married, but has this second Elaine that he still loves very, very much. I think at one point in the book you say you are a widower with a wife, in the sense that you have lost the first Elaine but have the second Elaine, and the two of you have actually a very, very special and loving relationship. Let's find out about the moment when you first began to sense that something was wrong with your wife, Elaine. What were the first indications, and how old was she when there were the first signs of trouble?
Well, Elaine, this goes back 13 years ago about. She was 64, 65 in that age area. And among the things that occurred, she would back the car in and out of the garage as she had been doing for, you know, what, almost 60 years and maybe almost 50 years. But anyway, the point was she would be scratching the side of the door. She worked with the Silver Spring Neighborhood Center, which was here in Milwaukee at the other end of town, and she would get lost at times going to and from that place where she worked and was involved in being of assistance there. And she was a terrific cook. Oh, my gosh. And what happened was we had, you know, a special dinner party, and when the meal was served, there was very, very apparent that there was something wrong in the recipe, that there was too much of one thing and not enough of another. And but then also she would, you know, come up with stories about things that I thought remembered never happened. And so these were the beginning signs of it all. And so we had a family doctor, and this family doctor said, you know, I think it would be good to have your wife tested. And there is a test that they do, which is a very simple test, sort of interesting, that they can get such in-depth understanding of the disease by simple questions such as who's president of the United States, what day is it, what month it is, and so forth and so forth. But Elaine was tested, and the median, the form, the test score, 30 or above, meant everything was all right. And 30 or below, that was maybe the beginning onset of Alzheimer's. Well, the first time Elaine was tested, she was at 28, which is still pretty good, but it was a sign of early onset. And so that sort of began to create an understanding of why the car was being scraped or why she was getting lost or why the cooking that she had done for so long, which was so great, all of a sudden was becoming diminished. And so as we both prayed together and cried together and tried to make the best out of this, Elaine fought so hard to try and be as appearing as normal as she could. And we would have a go out with friends, and by the end of the evening she was so exhausted because her mind was working so hard to be as attuned as possible. But as these years passed, the score would drop from 28 to 24. And now the last time that we had an opportunity to visit the Alzheimer's specialist, her score was 8, which wow. means that in that some 13-year period of time, her world had grown smaller. And one important lesson that I wish to share with anyone who has the opportunity to be a heroic caregiver is to understand that their world is small, and the sooner you can join their world, the happier you and the person with dementia will be. And to learn also that the person's brain is broken. And because of the broken brain, you cannot argue any way intellectually with the person who has Alzheimer's, because their world knows only that which is right in front of them. Something which happens 5 minutes from now or happened 5 minutes ago is not in their world. So what I had to learn, and it's very, very difficult, but what I had to learn was to let go of the first Elaine, was to understand that this person who once was is no more, and to understand I could no longer expect to have the same kind of friendship, the same kind of conversation, the same kind of counseling, the same kind of discussion about children, family, and friends, and so forth, that was something which is now gone and passed. And so at that point then, I became a widower. And as the new Elaine, as the second Elaine came more about, I realized that this is a different person. But by the same token, probably one of those unique opportunities that a person rarely gets to be able to love the same human being in a different way. Mm. And as painful as this whole disease is, it is a wonderful thing to think that you can still have your second Elaine tell you, I'm so glad that you want to marry me. It makes me so happy. And I should mention, just by the way, that this is, first of all, Alzheimer's is number 6 of the top 10 killer diseases. And of those top 10, Alzheimer's is the only disease that cannot be prevented or cured or delayed. And so the question is, what do you do about it? I want to get back. If there is one thing worse than Alzheimer's, it's ignorance of the disease. And to reaffirm that if you should not worry about the storm to pass as much as try and learn how to dance in the rain. Mm. Now, in trying to learn how to dance in the rain, they told me that it is possible that Elaine may be getting better, you know, and of course this is irreversible, and the reason that they think that is that they heard Elaine tell me how handsome and good-looking I was. And, well, they took a look at me, and they said, well, immediately this woman knows what she's talking about. and so what they started to do was to look at how they, show the world about this, so they started to write an article for the New England Medical Journal, but they needed 3 things to prove that she knew what she was talking about. As you know, intelligent and good-looking, well, that's 2 things. Well, now the 3rd thing. So Elaine asked me many times how we met. And I said, well, Elaine, we met when we were freshmen in high school. And I said, I knew from the woman, well, from the very moment you were the woman I wanted to marry. And not only that, if any boy got within 50 feet of you, I popped him on the head. She looked at me and says, you're a BSer. Well, now they had the three things to show that this woman here was becoming better.
Hmm.
And, of course, what I'm doing is just trying to have people understand that you can try and enter their world and try and do the best. And entering their world, Elaine asked me once how her parents were doing. And I said, well, they're both dead. And to see the shock and the sadness on her face, I promised myself I wouldn't put her through that again.
And I think when you describe that moment, it's especially poignant when you said, well, yeah, they've both died, and then she asked you, I think, something like, oh dear, did we take good care of them? Did I go to their funerals? I mean, so not only had you, by answering that question honestly, not only had you, in a sense, shocked her into that grief all over again, but also on top of it, all kinds of anxiety because she couldn't remember whether or not she had handled that properly and showed them proper respect in such a moment. And you immediately regretted having spun all of those unhappy thoughts into her mind simply by answering a question honestly. That was an important lesson that you learned.
Yes, well, and so what I have, now when she asked me how her parents are, I say your parents are great. You know, they used to do a lot of work at church. So I said, Elaine, your parents are at church working, and they just called to say that they're really happy with how things are going with us. Oh, she says, I'm so pleased with that. I'm so happy. And, you know, I call that a therapeutic fibbing. And it's okay to therapeutically fib. Because it's their world again, and the more that we can join their world, the better we will be. But then to also, with understanding that you can't argue with Alzheimer's, it's so important for the caregiver to understand not only can you not argue with it, but stay out of the way. If the caregiver has to make some change in the person's life, like take away the car keys, it's not the person caregiver saying, it's the doctor. It's blaming someone else so the caregiver doesn't get in what I call the line of fire in the change and impact of this disease. And so, you know, therapeutic fibbing and blaming someone else, can you imagine how happy really of a marriage we would have had if way back when we first got married in 1961, if I would have told therapeutic fibs and blamed someone else, how much of a happier marriage we could have possibly had.
We're speaking with Martin J. Schreiber about his book, My Two Elaines, Learning, Coping, and Surviving as an Alzheimer's Caregiver. Martin Schreiber's wife, Elaine, was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease back in 2007. You talk a great deal in your book about the loneliness and isolation that you felt, particularly early on when you had not yet learned the importance of reaching out and in a sense being more open about what the two of you were experiencing and suffering through together. When she was diagnosed, who did you tell? How many people in your circle, I mean, I'm sure your family knew, your children knew, but beyond that, who did you decide to tell about her Alzheimer's versus how many people did you, in a sense, not share that information with? It sounds like you have some regrets and that you wish that you had been, in a sense, more open right from the start.
That's absolutely correct. I've concluded to describe Alzheimer's as not a chicken casserole disease. If I have a heart attack and I'm recuperating at home, people will bring me a chicken casserole. If I have hip surgery and I'm laid up, they may bring me a chicken casserole. With Alzheimer's, it's not a usual disease, and it's a disease that people feel uncomfortable with and even the caregiver. Can you imagine me, you know, just not wanting to share with good friends where Elaine is at and where Elaine is going. And there's, I think, and I try and get to this point in the book, that men, we men sometimes are so arrogant and self-centered and prideful that we are worried about our own self-image more so than being intelligent and courageous and sharing with our loved ones and our friends what is going on. And so Elaine and I would meet with friends, as I described before, and she would fight so hard to be normal, and she put on a pretty good impression of being normal. And so the next day people would call me and say, what are you talking about? You know, Elaine is really doing well. And I didn't have the courage to tell them, look, there's another 23 hours in the day. And so, I just felt that I wanted to handle this myself. I didn't want to share with other people what was going on. And what was happening in my life, it was beginning to close in on me because I didn't understand the constant repetitive questions and would become frustrated with that. I didn't really understand fully why things would disappear and take a while to find if I ever did find them, or why, you know, things ended up in the dishwasher that shouldn't be there. And so I just kept all that into my own self, my own head. And then I also, and this again goes back to the point of if Alzheimer's is bad, ignorance is worse, and trying to learn how to dance in the rain. Had I known some of these things earlier, had I known the importance of getting help so I could be a better caregiver for Elaine and so I could be a better father or a better grandfather, but no, I arrogantly and self-centeredly hung on to what I was doing because it was my job, and I said I would take care of her forever, and of course, you know, I wanted to do that, but the ridiculous part about it is that I was in the process of loving both of us to death.
Right.
My health became seriously affected, and she wasn't, you know, had more anxiety and nervousness and concern and worry than if I would have really been better and more intelligent about doing it.
Right. You write this at one point, and at this point in the book, you are very specifically speaking to any husbands who might be reading your book. So for husbands who have a wife suffering from Alzheimer's, you write this: I know that your natural instinct is to try carrying this weight alone. Being a real man means being brave, suffering in silence, and standing on your own two feet. You're not supposed to depend on others. There's a lot of truth in the old stereotype that male drivers don't like to stop and ask for directions. But to be a good caregiver, asking for help is exactly what you have to do. That's how you show how strong you are. You also talk about in this portion of the book that one of the things that happens, of course, as the wife begins to succumb to this, in your case, Elaine, that you end up having to take on certain roles in the marriage that were not your role before. And in the same way that when a wife loses a husband to Alzheimer's, that suddenly it might fall to their shoulders to have to fix the toilet or kill the bugs or whatever it is that maybe you relied on your husband to do. And that has to be a very interesting and sometimes very frustrating challenge as well, to realize that you are no longer the wonderful team that you once were.
Well, it's all part of the loss, and it's all part of the adjustment. And I think that's one of the reasons that makes caregiving such a challenge. And I will tell everyone, I will tell the world, the galaxy, that caregivers are real heroes. And the reason that they are real heroes is that there is no light at the end of this tunnel. And what they are doing is out of love and concern and compassion. And what makes this caregiving so difficult is, as you described, the fact that you're dealing with taking on a completely new set of responsibilities. Now, that alone in and of itself is a challenge. But then, in addition, you're faced with the emotional and the grieving and the sadness and maybe even the depression of not only taking on these additional responsibilities, but the most important thing of realizing your loved one is leaving you day by day, and they're going off into some kind of a different world that you don't know and they don't know, and they're worried about it. And then you have that, and then add to that the repetitive questions, the daily reminders that this every day is a new beginning, is a different experience. And as their mind begins to close down, so to speak, you're dealing with the loss of the car keys or the disappearance of a ring, or you're dealing with these repetitive questions and the sadness and all of that coming into play. And so, you know, there is that changing role, which is all part of it, but it's all another weight to be carried to try and sustain one's survival. And I think as people begin more to understand it and we become more familiar with it, it's going to be easier to go out and ask for help. And employers are going to be more inclined through employee assistance programs to say, hey, how can we help? And the medical profession is beginning to understand that when there's a diagnosis of Alzheimer's, there are two patients. There, of course, is the person with dementia, but then there's also the caregiver. And if we don't watch it, the caregiver's health statistically has proven to go down quicker and death come quicker as a caregiver as a caregiver for Alzheimer's than as a caregiver for example, a cancer patient.
Hmm. Say a word about the way in which Elaine began to change as the disease worsened. I want you to particularly talk about the way in which she began to lose interest bit by bit in almost all of the things that once upon a time had given her such pleasure, and which you had also together enjoyed with such pleasure. I should think that in and of itself was probably a very wrenching kind of loss, and probably one of the most tangible ways in which you felt the first Elaine slipping away. What were the kinds of things that she once loved to do that suddenly she either did not want to do or was no longer capable of doing or being interested in?
We loved biking. We just absolutely loved biking. And so when it got to the point where she no longer could, you know, really sort of keep her balance, I thought we needed that exercise. Biking and walking are the best exercise for the brain. And I felt we had to keep that going. So I took her to a bicycle store and I said, Elaine, let's try out this three-wheeler. And so she sat on the three-wheeler and she didn't know how to operate the handlebars to go straight or to turn. And she sat there for a moment and she pedaled and so forth. And this was very confusing to her. And she said, well, this is stupid. She says, we don't want to do this. And she walked off the bike, and that's the last time we did any biking. And so it was a great loss because it was something that we had enjoyed doing together for a very long time. And there was another experience where we enjoyed boating. And so we were on the boat, and there was a place to sleep, so we were sleeping. And in the middle of the night, the couple that we were with who were sleeping in another part of the boat came over to me and said, Elaine is here in front with us, and we wanted you to know that, and we're returning her to you. Well, my gosh, in order for her to leave where we were sleeping, she had to crawl over me. She had to go up a stair, and she had to move forward. And I thought, my God, if she would do that, she could wander out of the boat. She could stumble into the water, and then what a tragedy that would be. So both by losing, by having the brain shut down, we missed out on some of these kinds of experiences. Now, on the other hand, if you can join that person's world, when Elaine and I go for a walk and she wants to look at a bird or a flower, I now know how important it is to take the time to admire that bird or the flower. We can sit now and look at a tree and have a view of that tree with all of the amazement that one might feel looking at the Swiss Alps, all of the thrill of the beauty of it, of the rustling of the leaves and seeing it reflect through the blueness of the sky, and all of those things are so great. And so what is important, again, to learn how to dance in the rain, to know that there are things in your loved one's life that are going to be particularly meaningful to them, and the idea is to try and find them and to identify them, and then not only rejoice in them, but try and have as many experiences like that as possible.
Right.
And so it's been a learning experience, and again, I get to, if Alzheimer's is bad, ignorance of the disease is worse, and rather than worrying about the storm to pass, to try and learn how to dance in the rain.
Right. One of the things you say is that that she has a pretty high awareness of your feelings and moods. And what, at one point you write, helping her sense that I am happy to be with her is very important to you. And I've heard this from others as well, that an Alzheimer's patient might not know who's the president or know what month it is or know their address, but they know when you are unhappy or are agitated or feeling very, very worried. And of course, I'm sure at some point the disease progresses to such a point where even that is not possible. But for a long point, for a long time in this journey, you began to realize that you need to keep her as much at peace as possible, and you yourself need to be as much at peace as possible, because she will sense very clearly when you're not.
What a very important point that you brought up. The Alzheimer's Association came as close to saving my well-being as any person or organization could. And I go to counseling, and the counselor says that, and you know what has been bothering me? I said, I feel so guilty because I do not want to go see Elaine today, and I know I should see Elaine. And the counselor says, don't. And I looked, and I was surprised to hear that. And the counselor pointed out what you indicated in your question of me, but pointed out, and I'm rephrasing, the person with Alzheimer's life is so small, but because their life and their world is so small, they can sense and pick up more sensitivities than what I think even an ordinary person would. You know, I don't know. I once heard that a person who has no sight can hear better. Well, I don't know if that's the case, but I do know that Elaine's sensitivities and understanding of her immediate whereabouts are so acute. And so the counselor said, what? If you want to bring happiness and peace to Elaine, and you go in and you're anxious or you're frustrated or you're discouraged or you're sad and you reflect that, well, you're having the exact opposite effect of what you're trying to do. So it's okay for you to sit, maybe miss a day or maybe even 2 days. It's okay to know that there's this frustration that, or despair or anger that you might have. It's okay for you to try and leave that at the door. Important for you to leave it at the door and to check your frown at the door before you walk in the room, because that person needs you to be pleasant and supportive and in their world in a happy and in a comfortable state.
When you are describing this matter of the, in a sense, constriction of their world, Well, first of all, you're describing what it's like when you visit her at the care facility where she now lives, and you will you tell us that you spend a lot of time just looking out the window as she reacts to what she sees. Oh, that tree is so big, and the sky is so blue. Those flowers are so pretty, and you might even kind of restart that again and again, and try to enjoy her own sense of enjoyment. And then to help us understand this, you suggest that we go to the kitchen or go to the garage and get a funnel, of all things. Explain why looking through a funnel helps us understand the way your wife Elaine sees the world.
Well, that is something that came to me, and if you can take a funnel and put that narrow part of the funnel by your eye, and you look up and you can see the blueness of the sky and you can see the hope of tomorrow. That would be maybe how all of us who are non-afflicted with this disease might look and again see the brightness and the whole expanse of what is open to us. What happens then in the life of a person with dementia, with Alzheimer's, what happens is that funnel becomes inverted. And so then the very, very large part of this funnel is by your eye. And when you look out, all you can see is a very small circle of the outside. And that is what I would understand then the world of a person with Alzheimer's to become. Very small and very specific. And again, not worried about what's going to happen 5 minutes from now, what happened 5 minutes ago, but just very focused on the immediacy. And the funnel example is to help give us an understanding of what the person with Alzheimer's is dealing with, but then to reaffirm what you ask in your question about making sure that when we visit a loved one, that we are as much as possible untroubled and pleasant and supportive, because the only world they know is the world that is right in front of them. Hmm. And if the world that is right in front of them is happy and of beauty in their eyes, it's a wonderful experience. And if the world that is right in front of them is confused and anxious and worried, disheveled, boisterous, then it's an extra kind of a challenge. And I think it's important to also understand that their personality is affected by what is going on. And maybe affected is a good word, but reflected maybe is even a better word, that their personality reflects the world around them. Mm. And so anyone who has an opportunity to be a loving caregiver or friend is to understand that they're like a mirror, and what they are saying and talking about and reflecting an attitude is going to be directly played back by the person who is ill.
When her disease had progressed to the point, I think that really scary episode on the boat that you told us about earlier, I think that was really the moment you realized she is just not going to be safe if she remains at home, that she needed to live someplace where she could really be properly cared for. One of the ways that you were able to accept that was because of something your counselor at the Alzheimer's Association had said to you. She said, when the time comes, you are not putting her in a nursing home. You are not putting her anyplace. I thought that was really interesting, that choice of words could help you sort of come to terms with this reality, that you weren't putting her in a nursing home. In a sense, the disease was putting her there, but it was the best place she could be at that point.
That, again, is so salient of a message. There is so much guilt out there. There is so much promise that one makes about taking care of the person forever. And when I said, I cannot, when I told the caller, I can't see putting Elaine into a home with the keyword putting, she said, you are not putting Elaine anyplace. What you are doing is giving her an opportunity to be the person who she is now. And as I reflected on that, that's true. Marty Schreiber's 24/7 nursing home care was incapable of helping Elaine be who she is now, either because of my diminishing physical stamina, because the increased emotional challenges that reflected sometimes frustration and maybe more harshness than what was necessary. And when we were at home, I would have trouble sleeping at night because I was afraid that she would walk out the door and be gone, and I wouldn't know where she is, so I wouldn't sleep well at night. And then during the day, again, the constant repetitive questions, which no matter how much I loved her, they sure seemed to be so too repetitive as far as I was concerned. But then we would go for a walk, and we would come back, and we would sit for 5 minutes. She said, let's go for a walk. Or we would go for a walk, and we would come back and sit for five. She wanted to go for a walk again. And so my world, and, you know, we use the example of the funnel, and that happens in the caregiver's life as well. You begin with looking through the small part and seeing the expanse of the sky and the hope of tomorrow, and then the caregiver's life changes, and you become so focused on taking care of your loved one that your world is smaller, and because your world is smaller, you're more feeling put upon, surrounded, uncomfortable and uncontrolled. You feel you're not in control, and that has all kinds of emotional reflections through causing different actions and responses. So when the counsel explained to me that I was not putting Elaine anywhere but giving her an opportunity to be who she is now, and then went on to more fully explain to me how important it was for me to be of a sound mind and body to take care of Elaine, but then to also go on to understand, and every caregiver has to understand it, that I know that that's what Elaine would have wanted me to have done, to make sure that I too would not have my life dissipated, but that she would still want me to be a good father and a good grandfather and a good friend to our friends, as well as a good great-grandparent. And so it was a closing of the door, just such a heartbreaking closing of the door to have her move into assisted living memory care. But by the same token, it allowed me to become a better caregiver. It allowed me to become a better father, better friend, a better grandfather. And there's a lot of blessing in that too.
Absolutely.
And I know that Elaine, is happier and more content and better cared for than I could ever do it.
You write, the person my wife is now finds happiness in lots of things. We listen to music and sing. We play catch. We play board games without rules. We color. We do simple art projects. I know Elaine benefits from the comfort and security that comes from just being with me and other people who love her, including the people she gave her life to. Everyone deserves that bit of dignity. I still need her, and she somehow knows that. Martin J. Schreiber, thank you so much for writing this powerful and poignant book, and for sharing your story of your love for Elaine, the first Elaine and the second Elaine, and the story that will have very important and valuable lessons for all kinds of people. And I very much wish you well, you and Elaine both, in the years ahead.
Well, thank you. I want you to know I'm very grateful for the opportunity. I greatly respect and admire all of the wonderful things that you do and all of the involvement and awareness that you bring. So it's a great honor and a privilege for me to be with you. So thank you so very much.
You're welcome. This interview with former Governor Marty Schreiber was recorded and initially broadcast back in 2017. Earlier this year, on April 25th, Elaine Schreiber passed away peacefully at Hope Memory Care Assisted Living at the Lutheran Home in Milwaukee, named in her honor. She was surrounded by loved ones. She was 82 years old. Her husband's book, once again, is titled My Two Elaines.